This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this first full day of spring, it's snowing here in Washington. To be fair, it's snowing on robins, daffodils, and trees in bud, if not yet in bloom. And I have to admit that we're lucky. The inch or two of dusting that we're likely to get is nothing compared to what happened in Nebraska, Kansas, and Colorado yesterday and what the Ohio Valley is getting today. But still, the winter weary are eager to sow and plant for March Madness to give way to opening day for warmth and rebirth. The famous cherry blossoms are the unmistakable sign of spring in this city. Today, we want to hear what marks the change of the seasons where you live, what clues you look for, and whether they're arriving. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk to Christopher Moore about his new novel, which is about death, demons, and the hounds of hell. Don't worry, it's a comedy. But first, signs of spring. Our first guest is an inveterate gardener who plants her flowers in the northern climes of Vermont. Jamaica Kincaid is the author of Among Flowers, A Walk in the Himalaya. She joins us now from her office at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome. Is it snowing there, too?
No, not at all. It's a very nice, cool but brilliant sun shining.
Well, when you get up to Vermont, what is your sign of spring?
Oh, the daffodils, the early daffodils have begun to push up, and the carnelian dogwood is opening. It's a yellow flowering dogwood, and it's just about to spring open. It's very full. It's a yellow flowering one.
Mm-hmm. On the daffodils, do you take them as they come, or do you plant them?
I plant them. I have quite a lot, but in particular, I'm planting a lawn. Eventually, I want to have 10,000 of them, but so far I only have five. I've only been able to afford 5,000. And when they start blooming this spring, I'm going to recite half the Wordsworth poem.
I wandered lonely as a cloud.
As a cloud, yes.
That floats on high o'er vales and hills. That's when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. He talks about 10,000. You've only got five.
I've only got five, but I'm working on it. Next year I'll plant another two, and then eventually when I have 10, I'll recite the whole poem.
And I suspect you may have a pretty good bumper crop of squirrels, too.
Oh, they don't do that. They leave that alone. That's one of the things that all the animals seems to leave alone, but not. So I don't have tulips, and I certainly don't have crocus.
Uh-huh.
They're all been, the squirrels do have a go at that.
Mm-hmm. Are daffodils all you put in your garden?
Oh, no, no. Oh, gosh. No, but those are the first things I see coming up, and then some early blooming peonies, Peony japonica. That starts coming up, and then I some oh gosh, now that I'm talking to you, I can only see the picture. Daphne, I have a Daphne that's just about to bloom. It's a very early one.
What's Daphne? Explain that to me.
Oh, it's a lovely. Well, it's a kind of big family, but the one I have is a lovely little shrub that blooms, flowers first and then leaves after, and it's very fragrant.
This must be wonderfully rewarding when you stand there amongst all those thousands of daffodils.
It is. Well, yeah, it is wonderful to stand in it, but most beautiful is to stand afar and just see it cascading down a little knoll, a little going down into a wetland garden. It's really very nice, and they're flowers that I have complicated feelings about because I was forced to learn that poem as a child about them. And as a child, I never knew what a daffodil was, but I knew about them a lot.
There are longer poems you could have been forced to memorize.
Well, this is true. A poem about the hibiscus, twice as long, would have been all right. I grew up with hibiscus.
Well, when do you expect that you're going to see that carpet of daffodils?
I think in about by the end of next week. They're an early blooming one. They come at all times, but this one is called, I think, Reinfeld's Early Sensation. It blooms much earlier than most daffodils, and they are very reasonably priced. They're actually quite cheap and beautiful, and so you can get about 500 of them for, I don't know, $50 or something. Mm. And you just, all you have to do is have the patience to just dig a hole and put them in 10 at a time, because you want them to grow in drifts. So you just have to patiently do that. It took me 4 days last year, last October, to get them in.
But come next weekend or so, your heart with pleasure will fill and dance with the daffodils.
Yes, it will. My heart will sing.
Jamaica Kincaid, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jamaica Kincaid, the author of Among Flowers, A Walk in the Himalaya. Also, Mr. Potter, a novel. She joined us today from her office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Talk at NPR.org. Dana is with us from Dayton, Oregon. What's the sure sign of spring in Dayton, Oregon?
Hi. Well, here at our house, it's the turkey vultures that I understand are coming back from South America.
So some people talk about swallows to Capistrano. You talk about the turkey vultures to Dayton?
That's right. It's a sure sign, and they swoop and ride the thermals and the fields around our house, and you just can't miss them.
They are magnificent birds from a distance.
Yes, this is true.
Well, are they there yet?
We have seen one or two, but mainly it's just still the red-tailed hawks, so not in full force.
All right. Well, we'll await the arrival then of the turkey vultures in Dayton, Oregon.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call, Dana.
You bet. Bye-bye.
The coming of spring has long been the subject for study by science. At first, the goal was to understand better how seasons change from one to the other. In more recent years, scientists are interested in how spring itself might be changing. Joining us now for her home in Essex, England, is Jill Attenborough. She works for the Woodlands Trust, which, in partnership with the BBC, runs the Spring Watch Survey, the largest survey ever into the arrival of spring in the United Kingdom. Jill Attenborough, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
Explain a spring watch to us. How does it work?
Well, it only happens if everybody around the UK takes part, and that's what they've shown they're very keen to do. And we ask people to look out for six signs of spring. The first time they see the seven-spot ladybird, the first time they see frog spawn, peacock butterflies, the red-tailed bumblebee, hawthorn flowering, and swifts arriving back from Africa. And they tell us those dates. They can either enter them into our website or they can send them on a postcard. And we collate all that information, and it helps us to understand how the changing temperatures, as our climate changes, how that's impacting on the natural world.
So you're looking for people with good eyesight here. The seven-spot bumblebee or the seven-spot ladybird?
Seven-spot ladybird, yeah. They don't move very far, so it's quite easy to stop and count the spots.
Now, how many people do participate?
Well, last year we had 157,000 observations, which came from about 100,000 people. So we're hoping for even more this year because we've introduced new ways of taking part. You can even use your mobile phone this year to take part.
Text messages.
That's right.
Now, as I understand it, this project is a resurrection of a project from the early 1900s.
Yeah, that's right. I think phrenologists have been going in the UK for several hundred years, but there was an official scheme run by the Royal Meteorological Society in the UK from 1896 through to 1947, and then it just sort of died a death just at the time that we were seeing human-induced climate change start to kick in and affect the natural world. And then it was resurrected again in 1998 by my colleague, Dr. Tim Sparks, who saw the potential for it being very useful for our study of climate change. But we've been able to, fortunately, turn to individuals who've just kept diaries over that time. And I'm sure lots of people in the States have done the same, just noting down year after year when the first daffodils are seen or when the first turkey vultures come back. And they provided us with up to 50 years of records of what they've been seeing in spring and in autumn. And that fills a gap, and it means we've got really good records to look back and understand how climate change is affecting us.
And obviously building a better base of observation now. And it's hard to make determinations based on what you've been able to find. But what have you been able to find?
Well, we've been able to see that spring is coming 2 to 3 weeks earlier than it would have done 30 years ago. And that's quite a rapid change over a short period of time. Some things are responding faster than others. We know that insects respond fastest of all. They can bring forward their life cycle quite considerably just in one season. But even things like birds laying eggs is coming forward by about half a day each decade. So, quite big changes. We think there are going to be some winners and some losers. The balance of nature we can see is being affected as food source like caterpillars are arriving earlier before chicks are hatching out. We're also seeing some changing behaviour as well. Birds that used to migrate, like blackcaps and chiffchaffs, they used to migrate off to warmer places. They're now starting to stay with us because our winters are milder. The same is true of a particular butterfly, the red admiral butterfly. It's starting to stay with us all winter.
You used a word earlier, phenology, not phrenology, which means you're looking at the bumps on people's heads. What is phenology?
Phenology, yeah, we often get confused there. It's the study of the timing of natural seasonal events. So if you note when you first see a snowdrop here in the UK, or you first see a daffodil or a turkey vulture, then I think you qualify as a phenologist. You're studying the timing of the seasons.
And one of your older correspondents in the past used to keep notes on, as I understand it, an outhouse wall.
Yeah, that's right. We've discovered some fantastic records. And there's a family over in Worcestershire, three generations, when they used their outhouse and they first heard the cuckoo in the springtime, they'd write down the date. And that record has been transcribed so that we have it as a wonderful way of seeing how the timing of the cuckoo arrival in the UK has changed. But we've got records from people painting the dates when they see daffodils flowering on their garden sheds, people scribbling down when the swallows arrive on their walls inside their houses, all sorts of ways of keeping records, not just in a diary.
Mm-hmm. And you personally, what is your personal, sure, guaranteed sign of spring?
Well, my one is when the swallows come back from Africa. I'm fortunate enough to live on a farm, and we have several families of swallows that make their nests here around the farm buildings. And I know that they arrive back about the middle of May, and usually one arrives back before the others. But that's my sign. I feel that, you know, we're well on the way when those swallows are safely back.
Jill Attenborough, good luck with the survey. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Jill Attenborough, manager for the Phenology Project with the Woodlands Trust in the UK. She joined us from her home in Essex. So what is the unmistakable sign of spring where you live? Has it arrived? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Coming up after the break, baseball diamonds in Florida and snowdrifts in North Dakota. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about signs of spring. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. John is with us on the line from Brewerton in New York.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, John.
Hi. Well, usually up here at spring, one of my first signs is that the lake that I live on, Oneida Lake, breaks up usually about April 29th. And what you hear is when the lake breaks up, is a sound almost like floating crystal, like if you were washing a sinkload of wine glasses, just a slight tinkling of the ice moving across the lake as the wind blows it by. It's a real beautiful sound.
That sounds great. A lot of people with lakes that freeze over will put an old junker car out there and put up a lottery to pick the day when it's going to go under.
Right. Now, they do that in some of the areas up here with a large barrel, and there's a lottery where they drop it in up in the Adirondacks about an hour from here.
I think cars might present some pollution effects. Maybe make sure you take all the oil and gasoline out of it.
Right. They do. They also lend to navigational problems.
Well, it depends how deep the lake is.
There you go.
So any progress on melting yet?
Well, this has been a funny year because the lake has actually been partially thawed many times this year, three or four times. And right now I'm standing in the backyard. My bay is frozen, yet as I look out onto the main lake, we have a lot of open water.
No, it may not be so good this year, then.
No, I'm afraid it's not going to be. But yesterday morning I looked out and this whole bay was frozen at about 6 o'clock in the morning. So there's still time.
There's hope left. John, thanks very much.
We
wish you luck. Bye-bye. Of course, baseball to many people is the signal of spring. Couple of weeks till opening day, but spring training is well underway in both Florida and Arizona. Last night, the Washington Nationals announced a full lineup against the Los Angeles Dodgers, but then only eight players ran out onto the field. Alfonso Soriano, the team's highest player, paid player, refused to play ball. For more, we go to Mark Zuckerman, baseball reporter for the Washington Times. He joins us from the Space Coast Stadium in Viera, Florida. Nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me today.
So Alfonso Soriano just came back from playing in the World Baseball Classic, and so this was his first game opportunity for the Washington Nationals. Why didn't he want to play?
That's a good question, and I think a lot of people would like to ask him that thing, and he hasn't really spoken to too many people since. What it amounts to is this. He has, for the last 5 years of his major league career, been a second baseman with the New York Yankees and then with the Texas Rangers. The Nationals traded for him this winter, and at the time of the trade said they planned to move him to left field, both because they already have an all-star second baseman named Jose Vidro, and also because they don't feel that Soriano is a very good defensive second baseman, that he'd be better suited to play left field.
And statistics would bear them out, but...
Yes, he commits a lot of errors. He has not been a good defensive second baseman. Now, he's never played the outfield for any length of time, but the club feels like he could learn that and be less of a liability out there. And, mm-hmm. and they're more more concerned with his bat. That's why they wanted to acquire him, because he's one of the better offensive players in the league.
Well, when they traded for him, did anybody ask him beforehand and say, well, if you're going to come over here, would you mind playing a little left field?
No, they didn't, and that's been the major issue. Jim Bowden, the Nationals GM, general manager, attempted to talk to Soriano at the time, but you have to get permission from his former club, the Texas Rangers, and the Rangers said, no, we're not going to let you talk to him. Soriano had made this position clear before that he was not interested in ever switching positions. So they had to know this was going to be an issue. I think they knew it, but they also felt like deep down when push came to shove, they would meet with him and he would agree to make the move. And so everyone convened last night. They put him in the lineup, and I think fully expected him to say, okay, I may not be a big fan of this, but I'm going to go ahead and do it.
If for no other reason that the man telling him to go out and play left field was Frank Robinson, the Hall of Fame ball player, who might have told him, son, when you win Most Valuable Player awards in both leagues, then come and talk to me about where you want to play.
Yeah, good point. I think that's why most felt that of all people that should be able to persuade him that Frank would be the guy here, you know, one of the most well-respected players in baseball history and a well-respected manager. And the funny part of it is he and Soriano have talked many times during the spring and met yesterday, and they both say it's been very cordial, been very positive. They like each other. They have respect for each other. Alfonso just does not want to budge on this position switch, and last night we saw that how far he, you know, to what lengths he would go to prove that point.
And if he doesn't do it again on Thursday, we're told he may get up on a list where he would be disqualified and would not collect his $10 million that he's scheduled to make this year.
Right. The team's off today, but tomorrow's their next scheduled game against the St. Louis Cardinals. The team plans to put him in the lineup again in left field. And if he does not take the field, they will petition Major League Baseball to have him placed on the disqualified list. And what that means is, like you said, he forfeits his salary, which is $10 million, most on this team. He also would apparently lose his would not accrue any service time as a major leaguer. And that's important because at the end of the season, if he plays, he's going to be a free agent and be able to sign with any club that wants him. If he is on the disqualified list for the full season, the club believes that he will remain their property and therefore will not be allowed to become a free agent mm-hmm. at the end of the year. So in theory, this could just keep going around in circles for years and he would never, you know, get the opportunity to go somewhere else.
So I guess the first world-class rhubarb, a guaranteed sign of spring.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's one of the negative signs of spring, but it is one of them, yes.
Mark Zuckerman, thanks very much for being with us and have a great time there in Florida.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Mark Zuckerman, baseball reporter for the Washington Times, joined us from the Space Coast Stadium in Viera, Florida. And here's an email. If people wanted to come to Texas, I might say spring is the beautiful blue bonnets and Indian paintbrush, along with the plethora of other wildflowers. If I wanted to keep people from coming to Texas, I might say spring is the coming of fire ants, scorpions, mosquitoes, stink bugs, and the like. That from Mike Howell, who sent us an email. The sign of spring in Fort Erie, Ontario, writes Lauren Attard, is the carp spawning in Lake Erie. And today, the Shake Shack in Madison Square Park reopened. Bradley Price writes us, I've been looking forward to it all winter. It's a sure sign that spring cannot be mistaken. Well, let's turn now to Barry. Barry's calling us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi, Barry.
So, yeah, we do have spring here. We really do. And there are seasons. But to me, it's always been the smell of orange blossoms.
Orange blossoms on the air.
Yeah.
And when does that happen?
That happens actually in another week or so. It's a little bit late, and because we've had so much drought, I think most of those trees have kind of just done this later than usual.
So spring arriving a little later than usual there in Scottsdale, Arizona.
And it's chilly today. It's 68 degrees, and I know that has no sympathy to folks.
Absolutely none, no. Barry, have a great time when the orange blossoms emerge.
Thank you, Neil. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's turn now to TC. TC calling us from Mayer, Arizona. Mesa, is that?
Hello, Neil.
Hi, TC. Go ahead.
Hey, buddy. I actually work in Phoenix. I'm a fireman in Phoenix, so I concur. It's the orange blossoms. But in northern Arizona, where I live, you know, you get away from the city lights, and it's this huge, big, beautiful sky at night, and you see Scorpio in the southern sky. And that's my sure sign of spring, because I always equate that to the warm nights and just the beautiful weather that we have during this time of year in Arizona. Because like Barry said, you know, it's 60 degrees where I'm at right now. But, you know, those 115 degree days are coming, and we know it.
Yeah,
so.
But it's dry heat. It's dry heat.
Well, it don't matter. It still feels like you're stick your head in an oven. Everything you touch is hot.
I'll accept that, but fly to Houston, or for that matter to Washington, D.C. in the middle of August, and tell me whether it's hotter there or here. It's debatable. Anyway, T.C., thanks very much for the call.
I love you. Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye. Here's an email we got from Christina Gwynn in Stanford, California, from our family's student housing courtyard. We know spring is here when we see herons swoop in to eat a gopher. The kids love it. In Grand Forks, North Dakota right now, the temperature is about 25 degrees. There's no snow in the forecast, but there's about 10 inches on the ground. Doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon, which is why Brad Dockin wrote in his column this week, "I'm ready for spring." Mr. Dockin is the outdoors editor for the Grand Forks Herald. He joins us now by phone from his office there. Nice to have you on the program today.
Very good. Good to be here.
I want to start by reading you a passage from your column. In true form, March has been a mix of good and bad, teasing us with signs of spring one day, yanking the rug out from under us with wet snow or plummeting temperatures the next. For me, at least, that's hard on the psyche. You wrote that on Sunday. You feeling any better?
I am feeling a little bit better. I mean, at least the sun is shining here. Been able to get outside a little bit and make the best of it, and that's pretty much the way you have to look at it right now. You play the card you're dealt and just make the best of it and try to enjoy it. Spring's not here yet, but you know, readers are telling me it's not far away.
Yeah, well, you mentioned readers. You have a Signs of Spring project there that you run. What have you heard from your readers?
The first batch of signs are coming in. It's a feature we started up here about 2 years ago. I kind of borrowed it from a sister paper in Duluth, Minnesota, over on the kind of on the other end of Highway 2 here. And you know, some of the early signs I'm hearing about are snow geese are arriving. They're heading north up to Hudson Bay, and they're passing through the country. It's a absolutely spectacular sight when they come through. You'll see literally thousands of birds fill the sky. And the first, first batch of them are trickling through right now. Another reader wrote to say that some rhubarb is optimistically poking through the ground on the south side of their garage. Got a picture of a cat sunning itself in the sun, and some bald eagles are showing up in the area. So, you know, subtle signs, but they are happening.
Which, for you personally, when it happens, you'll say, ah, it's spring.
I think the snow geese are a pretty telling sign. I have not seen them yet myself, but I did see kind of an interesting sign and, you know, sort of a real classic case of the fact we are at kind of a contrasting time here right now. Is yesterday I spent the morning ice fishing. I was snowmobiling and sitting in a nice warm fish house on 2 feet of ice, and yet just a few hundred yards away there was a river flowing out. The river had open water, and there were probably about half a dozen tundra swans on that open water. So they seem to be pretty optimistic. They've made it this far north, so it's good to see. I was glad to see the open water, and even happier to see the swans.
So you started this project about 2 years ago, so I guess spring should be arriving any week now.
Well, we're about 2 weeks behind schedule as far as the traditional spring right now. But you know, like I say, we just got to keep the faith. And readers are, you know, they're very subtle signs, but like I say, they're showing up, and everyone's real glad to see them.
Brad Dockin, thanks very much. Brad Dockin is outdoors editor for the Grand Forks Herald, and he joined us by phone from his office there in North Dakota. Here's an email we got from Rich Swanson. I live in western Colorado desert where there's very extensive canal system in place for irrigation. During the spring, before the water comes, farmers and canal company employees clear weeds from the canals by burning them. As a result, the desert valley smells of burning weeds, and this smell, he writes, reminds us of spring. If you'd like to join our conversation on the signs of spring where you are, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us email, talk@npr.org. We got this from Peg Dawson. I live within a mile of the track where they run the Indianapolis 500. The racing teams are in off and on during the year to test engines and tires. So besides the normal signs, robins, daffodils, the motorcycles are out, we in Speedway know spring is coming when we can hear the cars running at the track. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Carrie. Carrie's with us from Ogdensburg, New Jersey.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Ooh, this is exciting.
Go ahead.
My sign of spring isn't really very scientific. It has to do with a ritual my mother started years and years ago. She has this whole theory about how the trees shine towards the end of winter up here in northern Jersey.
I grew up in northern Jersey, shining trees, yet to see it.
Yeah. Well, she has this whole theory about how their sap rises and they shine and they're happy. And the problem is that she's been telling this every year to her classroom full of kids. And so we now wait for her telling of the shining of the trees as a sign of spring coming about a month away.
Hmm. All right. You might want to check. Is your mother still teaching school?
She is, but she's an English teacher. She's not a science teacher.
Ah, so it's a metaphor. It's not a fact.
Well, I guess that depends on who you ask.
Carrie, thanks very much for the call. Good luck finding some shining trees this season.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The first sign of spring in Adrian, Michigan, writes Millie Pruitt, is the sound of the plastic big wheels on the sidewalk as neighbor kids come out of hibernation and begin playing outdoors. Let's turn now to Marilyn. Marilyn's calling from Alpine, Texas.
Hello?
Marilyn.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I live down here in southwestern Texas near Big Bend National Park, and our sure sign of spring is when the mesquite trees begin to leaf out. Supposedly, we won't have another frost or hard frost after the mesquite trees leaf out.
So you don't pay much attention to Punxsutawney Phil. You look at the mesquite trees.
Right.
All right. Have they blossomed this year yet?
Yes, and we're beginning to get our vultures back as well.
Your vultures back as well. Buzzards seem to be a big sign for everybody.
Yes.
Marilyn, good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Kate in St. Louis writes, everyone in Cardinal Nation awaits the first true sign of spring, the sound of play ball, as the boys with the birds on the bats return to roost in their new stadium. Let's go now to Evelyn. Evelyn's with us from Fairbanks in Alaska.
Hi, how are you doing, Neil?
Very well. What's the first sign of spring there in Fairbanks?
Well, our yard glaciers begin to recede.
Yard glaciers?
Yes. We have snow. I'm up in the interior Alaska, and winter's 6 months long. And over that period of time, we get a lot of snow and ice, and it turns into mini glaciers in our yards. And when those begin to recede, then we know it's springtime.
And have they begun to recede as yet?
Not yet. The sun, we have nice long days, and everybody's out skiing, and the temperatures are mild, but the yard glaciers are still firmly in place.
We'll look forward to the retreat of the glaciers there in Alaska.
Yes.
Evelyn,
thank you.
Thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And sign of spring, Congress just went into recess. St. Patrick's Day week, a long break. That's another sign of spring here in Washington, D.C. Here's an email we got from Andy. I know spring is here when my bat house has its first bats. Right now, I have about a dozen little brown bats. By midsummer, I should have about 200. They are always welcome here in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And let's see if we get one last call. This is Daniel. Daniel, go ahead, please.
Hi.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
And what's the sure sign of spring in Charlotte, North Carolina?
The sure sign of spring in North Carolina and in the rest of America for students is that we are buried in papers and deadlines and homework.
So the rest of us, leaves fall in the autumn there in North Carolina. Students are deluged by falling paper in the spring.
Absolutely. That's how we know spring is here.
And you drown your sorrows by going off on spring break.
Absolutely. Exactly how I drown my sorrows.
All right. Have a good time, and make sure you get those papers done before you go.
Well, I'm on my way to do them right now. Thanks a lot.
All right, Daniel. Thanks very much for the call. I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but thanks to all of you who called into our correspondence on the front of changing seasons across the nation. When we come back from a short break, author Christopher Moore applies his unique brand of humor to such topics as demons and the world's major religions. This time around, he tackles death. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.